Among high-income countries, voter turnout in U.S. elections, which was 62% in 2020, is below average, especially when compared to some of our peers, like the countries of Turkey, Sweden, and Belgium, which has a turnout at 78% or higher. Though off-year elections typically get low voter turnout, or lower turnout, rather, two major statewide issues on the ballot last week made Ohio's statewide turnout on par with the 2022 midterm elections, according to the Secretary of State's office. The November general election also highlighted areas, however, with consistently low turnout, like in Cleveland, with almost, 29% turnout, which was far behind Cuyahoga County's 45%. Last month, Innovation Ohio released a report focused on the 2.7 million people sitting out of Ohio's elections. It found roughly 1 in 5 inactive voters are Black, and 64% are younger than 50. And many unregistered voters live near the three big cities in Ohio: Cleveland, Columbus, and Cincinnati, the big three. Today, we're going to talk to two local experts about efforts to engage voters in Cleveland and elsewhere and look ahead to 2024, which features a presidential election. Joining me by phone this morning is Erica Anthony, Executive Director of Cleveland Votes. Erica, thanks so much for calling in.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Good morning to you. We also have Kayla Griffin, president of the Cleveland NAACP and the Ohio State Director of All Voting is Local. Kayla, thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And of course, if you'd like to join the conversation, call 866-578-0903 or 216-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org or you can tweet us. We are at Sound of Ideas. And again, later this hour, we'll talk about a PBS series that highlights the modern Native American experience in this country. But first, voting. Erica, we talked about some negatives with voter turnout, but we should also mention there were some positives. Turnout was 5 points higher in Cleveland this year than in last off-year's election in 2021 by about 5 points, which featured a mayoral election, and it was about 15 points higher than in 2019. So do you think there is reason to celebrate turnout last week in Cleveland?
Yes, I really do. It's very complicated when we think about what is happening in the world and what is happening specifically in Northeast Ohio. I do think we have to celebrate and not only focus on the lower voter turnout. Particularly this year, we had a special election in the summer, which is unusual for most people not to engage in elections during the summertime. So there was a lot of confusion that we as practitioners were dealing with this election cycle, both in August and this past November. So with that said, I think we have to be appreciative of those that understood the issues that were on the ballot. I do think that the two statewide issues were a big factor into why so many people showed up to the polls, not just here in Cleveland, but throughout the state, as well as having two local issues, our issue 5, our Tri-C levy, as well as issue 38, the participatory budgeting levy that was on the ballot. And I think it represents that people want to see themselves on these issues that represented the ballot this year.
And how did you think issues 1 and 2 came into play?
Yeah, so when we think about reproductive rights and the prospect of having recreational marijuana, I think these really connected and resonated with Clevelanders particularly, but those across the state and across the nation. Mm-hmm. Every day, voters are feeling as if their voices are not being heard, that their values are not being represented by the elected bodies that represent them. And citizen-led ballot initiatives are a great way for voters to say, yes, I believe in this, or I don't believe in that, right? And as a nonpartisan organization, is incredibly important for us that we educate voters so that they can make the best and most informed decisions. And in this particular case, we were in favor of issue 1 and issue 38, particularly, as well as issue 5 as an organization. But we spent a tremendous amount of time over the summer into the fall educating voters with factual information so that they could, in fact, make those best informed decisions.
And then, Erica, you know, generally, when we're talking about Cleveland and, you know, we're throwing out statistics showing that it's behind Cuyahoga County and generally far behind other counties and the state as a whole, what are some of the biggest reasons that you kind of in this world who works on this, what are the biggest reasons for those low numbers?
For sure. Well, I'll first reference a study that Cleveland Votes, along with Policy Matters Ohio, conducted just over 2 years ago, coming off the 2020 election, where we did see lower turnout in Cleveland in comparison to some of our sister cities across the state. We were curious to better understand why Clevelanders specifically were or were not turning out. And I think some of the top lines of that particular study first noted that respondents definitely said they were not apathetic, which is tends to be a theme that we hear when voter turnout is lower. The respondents were clear that they had deep concern about what was happening in their respective communities and their neighborhoods, however, did not necessarily trust those, again, in power to represent their issues equitably and fairly as it related to what they wanted to prioritize. I think the second factor that was pretty high, and again, the study was conducted in 2021, so we were still at the height of COVID, people had a lot of concerns about accessibility and whether or not they had equitable access to healthcare, to proper PPE at the time, and making sure that, again, that their families, their children were able to connect to services in a way that allowed them to remain safe. I think if we extrapolate upon that research in 2021 and see where we are in the state of affairs in Cleveland today, we do have a lot of challenges that we're mitigating, whether we're talking about environmental injustice, issues with lead poisoning, continued disparities as it relates to healthcare and education. These issues are not separate from our democracy at large. They're deeply intersected, they're deeply connected. And so for us as an organization, we took a lot of time this summer, particularly going into the fall, talking with residents. We introduced a number of new programs, civic dialogues, where we really just sat down and both listened and also made sure that we made ourselves available. And Kayla was in partnership along with a number of other organizations to be a part of these conversations and civic dialogue. We can't wait just for when, you know, we are in a mode of crisis or the crunch time of GOTV to start to build relationships with individuals. They want to feel as if, you know, there's an ongoing relationship with them and the people that work in this larger democracy ecosystem.
Kayla, the Innovation Ohio report found roughly 1 in 5 inactive voters are Black. So what are some of the reasons why people in the Black community are registered but ultimately don't turn out to vote?
So I think Erica really hit it on the head with the research that they found talking to voters. We do a lot of voter registration drives in our communities. We do a lot to educate people of the importance of voting, but there are real consequential distrust within our communities, and there are real issues with accessibility. So we can do all the voter registration drives we want, but if people cannot make it to the polls, if there are restrictions on how they return their ballot, if our General Assembly is cutting days for curing ballots, if they are implementing ID laws that make it more restrictive for people to access the ballot, these are all direct implications of why we only have 1 in 5 Black voters in our state that are actually turning out, in addition to the emotional toil and distrust that people have for our lawmakers. And rightfully so. I mean, we just came off an election and we saw the numbers statewide and how voters turned out. And we have our elected officials telling the representatives or telling the constituents that they represent that they are going to ignore the will of the people. This erodes trust in our democracy, and it needs to be addressed and called out, and guardrails must be put in place for us to have trust in our system.
You know, we got an email from Daryl that he writes, it seems there are two issues involved in low voter turnout, lack of info, the fragmentation of news corresponding with the decline of newspapers, and poverty. How does voting affect poor populations? Time and time again, Cleveland ranks high, if not highest, for adult and child poverty levels amongst major cities in this country. How does that tie in to the voting or lack of voting that we're seeing in your mind, Kayla?
Yeah, I think two issues there. One, poverty is always going to impact us greater than just how we interact with our democracy. It costs a lot of money and time and energy to be poor. Statistics show us that the weight of people who are impoverished and below the poverty line is increasing steadily. And so when you are asking people to engage in a system that they do not trust, that they feel is not representative of them, while they are trying to put food on the table or work multiple jobs or have health care and child care, it tends to be burdensome. One of the things that I really appreciated in this last electoral cycle and engaging community members with Cleveland Votes leading the way on the table of a participatory budget is trying to help people understand how they can interact with this system and how much autonomy they really do have when we return power to the people. Mm-hmm. When we talk about poverty, when we talk about lack of information, when we talk about distrust in our system, these are people, somebody is making those decisions. And unfortunately, the everyday person who is represented by elected officials, they feel very left out of the system. Mm-hmm. They feel very left out of the decision-making process. And so we have to make sure that the people that we are electing are solving for those problems. These are decisions that are making poverty in Northeast Ohio can be eradicated. Lead can be eradicated. Food insecurity can be eradicated. We have brilliant minds who are leading our systems, but we have seen them come up short time and time again. And it really does beg the question, why should we continue to vote? Why should we continue to put our trust in these folks if they are failing us?
Erica Prentice Haney with the Ohio Organizing Collaborative recently called the Black vote in Ohio a sleeping giant. He told Ohio Capital Journal that of the 22,000 voters registered since June, 90% were African American. So are you seeing these new registrations at all in Cleveland? And do you think there is kind of this sleeping giant potential within Cleveland to be voting? But as Erica kind of so poignantly talked about, there are the realities of keeping up with life, and the harder you make voting, when you're trying to put food on the table and provide for your family and survive, that sometimes becomes the obstacle that falls lower on the agenda.
Yeah, most certainly. I mean, Prentice is spot on. I think, you know, as Kayla noted, that there are, you know, legitimate systematic barriers, right, that impact Black and brown folks, particularly here in the city of Cleveland, more so than our white counterparts. But the reality is that that does not mean that Black and brown individuals in the city of Cleveland are less interested and or have less concern, right? So I think it's really methodical for us to think through a process that is not just thinking about, oh, the 6 to 8 weeks leading up to an election, but what are we doing all throughout the year to really connect with voters, really to connect with people in a way that they understand how their vote makes a difference. This is exactly what Issue 38 was seeking to do. While yes, it was focused on the financial aspects of the budget for the city of Cleveland, it was really about connecting with Clevelanders, everyday people, for them to understand that they do in fact have power. Their voice is power. And 32,000 people said yes, right? And that says something. And while that's not the focus of today's show, I think it's a good example that individuals in this community do want to see something different. And we need to harness that energy. And we need to dig deeper beyond the surface level of this is the issue on the ballot, or this is the candidate on the ballot, but really help people understand what does this mean in the long term. I think to the person that sent the email about information is incredibly key. And while yes, there have been shifts in our mainstream media, we do have the advent of outlets like Signal and The Land and things that are really trying to elevate the stories, right? And I think that's the other piece here is that we could talk about quantitative data all day, every day, and it is incredibly important. This is someone that deeply values research, but we also have to hear the voices of the people. And the voices of the people are saying, as we've noted a couple of times, we don't trust the systems that are supposed to be working on our behalf. Time and time again, we are losing trust because we see the ways these actions are transpiring. As Kayla just noted, you know, not even 24 hours after the election, we had lawmakers in Columbus already talking about and coming together, signing on to a letter about how they were going to upend issue one,
right,
despite the fact that the majority of voters in this state voted in favor.
And introducing something, you know, for many unheard of taking autonomy away from the courts to somehow have the legislature take control. You know, there are differing thoughts on the actual reality of that being allowed. But still, being introduced in the legislature has a lot of people alarmed. I want to take a call from Anthony in Cleveland, who's on the line, wants to participate. Anthony, good morning.
Good morning. How you doing? I don't want to take too much time, but I want to sort of massage this thought I have. I live on Euclid Beach, and I reached out to all of the local political figures for a conversation about what's going on in our situation. And only one person came and stepped forward, and that was Elliot Forehand. Other than that, everybody else dark silent. The point I want to make is that I'm reiterating what has been spoken by your column, your people on the panel. I was at a district meeting for the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party head, Brock, was there. And I spoke to him and asked him the same question, said, can you have a conversation with me about what's going on? He talked about that they had an initiative in the Democratic Party of trying to get more African-American males to be engaged. And I told him in public that I would assist him if he'd have this conversation with me, because that's something that's very deep within my own heart, too, because I'm an African-American man. It has been dark silent. I called him, emailed him, everything. And the point I'm trying to make is, and the same thing happened with Sherrod Brown, reached out to him in all different channels. The politicians, it's not just with the Republicans, it's also with some of our local leaders, is that we have this, they are almost comfortable with people not voting, and they're being voted in with 10 and 15% backing, which means the flip side is 85% aren't voting for them.
Right.
And so people are casting their vote by not voting and by voting. So I just reiterate what you're saying. It's very a sad situation that's going on right now.
Anthony, I appreciate your thoughts. And Kayla, I mean, how would you respond to that? I mean, of course, you know, we know that the bureaucrats, the politicians are incredibly busy, you know, and may not be able to kind of personally engage with every voter. But at the same time, you know, this is someone who's actively trying to make his you know, to kind of extend himself and participate in the process, but feels rejected in a way. So, you know, is the apathy then of voters something that our politicians in Ohio are used to and comfortable with?
I don't think it's apathy. I think we have gotten extremely comfortable with, one, redistricting lines that allow politicians to choose who they represent, as opposed to having competitive races. So that's the first thing that we have to acknowledge. The second thing is our politicians often pander to the Black community for the vote when it is time for reelection.
Mm.
But we absolutely, as a Black community member and leader, we also have to hold them accountable outside of election time.
Mm-hmm.
We have to make sure that we are doing just as the caller said, calling them, trying to meet with them, engaging in conversation. And if they don't engage us, then we call them to the carpet when it's time for them to come up for vote. And we need to be galvanizing our community members to do the same. The major thing that stuck out to me in these last couple minutes is the Black vote has always been a giant of a vote.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a sleeping giant, but it's always been the backbone of our democratic system, and not a Republican or Dem, but the democratic system in at whole. We know that there is great power in the vote when we see how much money comes into our communities when it's time to turn out the Black community. But what happens is that those resources and that attention is only given when we want the vote. And so it's very transactional, as opposed to building the relationships that folks on the ground have been doing year after year. And that probably helps to lead some of this distrust, because the Black community is not, we're not shallow, we're not stupid. We know what transactional relationships look like. And it is looking like our politicians are only engaging in that manner.
Kayla Griffin, president of the Cleveland NAACP and Ohio State Director of All Voting, and Erica Anthony, executive director of Cleveland Votes. I'm sorry we've run out of time. We'll continue this conversation, though, definitely. I appreciate both of you joining me this morning.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And coming up after the break, we're going to have a talk about a PBS series called Native America that puts a modern eye on how indigenous people in the United States would like to be viewed today. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. With The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media, I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for staying with us this hour. A 2018 report from the First Nations Development Institute found that two-thirds of Americans had never met a Native American person. The report also showed the prevalence of stereotypes in popular culture, media, and sports, predominantly tethered people's associations of Native Americans with the past. A four-part PBS series produced by Providence Pictures, based in Rhode Island, is challenging those outdated perceptions by highlighting the prominence of modern Native American luminaries in shaping our future.
Native people are still here. We're scientists, we're engineers, we're doctors. We're not a stereotype from an 1890s Western. We are doing things to make a difference in this world.
Ajo. Nashado, walking in beauty. That philosophy encompasses many teachings to guide us to live in a harmonious way, being thankful and acknowledging who we are and our sacred footprints.
It's called Native America, and the second season premiered on PBS last month with the first episode, New Worlds, and the last episode airs tonight at 9 on PBS, online at pbs.org, and through the PBS app. Now, to share more about the series, we have the producer and director behind the series, one of the producers and directors behind the series, calling us today. That's producer Pam Bellegarde, who's a member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Anishinaabe. I hope I said that correctly. Thanks so much for calling in, Pam.
Abuju.
Good morning to you. And we have producer and director Charles Boots Kennedy, also member of the Kiowa tribe. Thanks so much for joining.
Thank you. Aho, Dande.
Yes, good morning. Also calling in from the West Coast is Aaron Yazzie, who is Diné from a small community bordering the Navajo Nation in northern Arizona. He's also a mechanical engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory and one of the voices featured in the series. Aaron, welcome to you.
Yeah, Ben, good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. And lastly in studio, we have Cynthia Connolly, Director of Programming at the City Club of Cleveland. She's also a citizen of the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Ottawa Indians in northern Michigan. Cynthia, thanks for being here.
Ani Bushu, Miigwech for having me.
Okay, that's maybe my most favorite greetings from all of our guests. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 866-578-0903 or 216-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Now, Boots, I'm going to go ahead and start with you, if I can call you that. We mentioned research that a majority of Americans haven't even met someone of Native descent, and depictions of Native people in the media and broader cultural landscapes tend to focus on stereotypes of long ago history. Why is it so important that we show depictions of modern Native people in our country, and how that's being done in this series?
Well, I think as modern Natives, we're pretty much all aware of that we have been written out of the canon of American history. So, you know, our experiences probably are not quite appreciated or recognized, you know, and we've been institutionalized and put on reservations. Reservation era was pretty much like putting people in concentration camps. And dividing us, separating us, putting us away, and to forget about Native people. So why people should be aware of Natives today is because Native people, you know, we all have the same desires. We want to do good. We want our families to do well, our children to be educated, and to, you know, be a part of our tribes and to improve our tribal communities. So... it's just wholly aware that, you know, that there's not a lot of Native people. We've been basically eradicated in ways that we're less than 1% of the entire population in the United States. Where I live in Oklahoma was one of the kind of the containers, was a place where they put tribes, you know, forcibly removed them from their homelands at gunpoint. And basically, you know, like the five civilized tribes, and there's 52 tribes in Oklahoma and 39 federally recognized tribes. So there's quite a diversity here in Oklahoma, but you know, nationally, you know, it's pretty thin.
Pam, I'd like to turn to you. Tell us more about, you know, kind of feed off of what Boots was saying, you know, the thought process on the concept here. So of creating some distance from the past. But of course, you know, in watching this series, there is a strong tie to the past and bringing out the beauty and the strength from then and kind of adapting that to now. But in this series, you really talk about kind of focusing on the present and the future, but acknowledging the past and its influence and significance.
Mm-hmm. First, I'd like to take a moment to introduce myself in our traditional manner. Abuju is Ashko Gijigo Kindigo, Migazi Dodem, Mekanako Wajuing Indonji. And I was taught that when we speak to anybody, out of respect for them and ourselves, we introduce ourselves in a traditional manner. So I want to take a few minutes to do that. And thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Regarding the series, I think something that really inspires and motivates people after they watch any of the episodes, because I have people coming up to me. We've been providing screenings throughout the country for the last month or month and a half. We've been crisscrossing the country. And I am so moved by their reactions to the screening, I mean, to the episode, whichever one they happen to watch. And I think one of the reasons that they feel that way is because what they see on the screen is what we know in our real life, you know, what we live and experience in our everyday lives. And that is that, you know, our values are up there on the large screen for everybody to see. Our traditional values that we incorporate in our everyday life. For example, one of the episodes is called Warrior Spirit. And, but this actually applies to, you know, all the stories that we covered in the episode, I mean, in the series, and that is that it's so obvious that we bring those traditional values that we've had for time immemorial, but it's in a much more modern context, and that's just brought forth, you know, in our lives, and people see it, you know, so you know.
Absolutely.
I think it's hard to explain. I'm probably not explaining it right.
That's okay. But you're doing great.
But if folks had would take the opportunity to watch at least one episode, I think they would be pleasantly surprised, educated. Their view on Indigenous people in the United States would be broadened,
right?
Because we're everyday people, just like everyone else, struggling with whatever happens to be going on, high inflation or whatever. But we also bring so much more to society and to our communities than that.
Now, Cynthia, I want to ask you, as you're local to our community, you are of Native descent. In hearing about the series and kind of what it's trying to do, how do you personally respond to that? And in your own kind of experience, do you also want the public at large to equate Native Americans with the present day and what we are doing, you are doing in society as a contributing American in some respects?
You know, I actually just had a conversation with a couple folks, that I work with over in my network at the City Club. And they asked me what was the number one pressing issue for our local Native community here in Cleveland, and is absolutely our visibility and representation. Mm-hmm. And that we are invisible and we're not represented in the city, in the county, in Northeast Ohio. And that the way that we're viewed right now in Northeast Ohio is in really these limited ways. I can count like to infinity the number of times I've been told that, I've never met a Native person until I met you, Cynthia. And wow. That's a lot of burden on anybody's shoulders, right? But I want people to realize that we are your coworkers, we are your neighbors, we are your community members. We're not perpetually fixed in the 1800s, feathered and leathered. We are absolutely part of this community and contribute to this community. And I will add that the mascot issue, particularly in the city, has really been one of the biggest hurdles that we had to jump in terms of overcoming that limited narrative that we've been stuck with. And since that name has been changed and that mascot has been gone, our community is seeing for the first time the ability to control our own narrative, our own identity. Sure. And there's a lot of opportunities that we're seeing opening up just because people are seeing us as actual human beings, like actual community members contributing to Northeast Ohio. So when a show like this, this series, like PBS Native America, comes out and really highlights just the amazing contributions that our Indigenous brothers and sisters are making, it really helps make the case as to why it's important to include Native voices here in Northeast Ohio. We have a LENAC, the Lake Erie Native American Council, for example, as part of a couple of planning sessions with like the North Coast Development Plan for the lakefront development, as well as the riverfront development over at Irishtown Bend. And our contributions they've really changed the way that they have approached the view and the development of that. And that's just because they brought us into that conversation. And frankly, that was the first time we had been brought into any conversation in the city. And just that, those sessions we've had have changed the game.
Right.
And that's why it's important to bring our traditions and our culture and our knowledge. And while, yes, it's adapt to the 21st century, it really makes a big impact and I think really helps inform something for everybody.
Aaron, I want to bring you into the conversation. You work at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, JPL, as a mechanical engineer. Not everyone can say that. That's incredible. How do you think this series helps break down stereotypes people may have of Native Americans?
I think it does a really good job of showing Native stories by Native storytellers. The whole time that I was helping film for this project, I was working with a team of people who were Native American, just like me, and they were asking the questions that were important to me.
Right.
And they really brought out the stories that I really wished to get out and to tell to people. I think just like everybody said on the panel, we want to show that we belong in this modern world, that we are contributing to the modern world in big ways. But also, well, like, we're just like you, but also we're not just like you. We also have a very unique situation and upbringing and community and background. And I think that our very unique, diverse backgrounds can contribute a lot to any team or workplace or society that we're trying to contribute to.
And Aaron, I think it's really cool that a piece of you in some respects, or at least your mind and your work, is on Mars.
Yeah, it's one of the most amazing things I've been able to contribute to is just science on behalf of the, not just like my community, but the entire humanity. And one of the coolest things is to like, for the longest time, this career, this path that I've been on in my education and now at NASA, I felt a little isolated. There's not very a high representation of Native Americans in the STEM fields, especially at NASA, where I feel like everywhere I am, I'm always less than 1% of the population.
Yeah.
Most of the rooms that I sit in, most of the meetings that I'm in, I'm the only Native American in the room. And so it's for the longest time, I felt outside of it. I felt like not part of it. And then all of a sudden, it's flipped completely over, and I'm in the middle of a flagship mission for NASA, contributing to one of the coolest missions going to Mars.
Yeah, I think people will recognize the name Mars Rover. I mean, your science basically helped with the drill. Am I saying that right?
That's right.
Yeah, that's a part of the and I remember watching the whole launch and all of that. And so to think of your work spanning the miles into our galaxy is really just fascinating. We have a bunch of callers who are interested in participating in the conversation, so I'm going to invite one in. Scott is calling from Oberlin. Scott, thanks for calling into the Sound of Ideas. Go ahead.
Hey, folks. I am just enjoying the heck out of this show. I'm over 60, and I can remember my parents taking me to a powwow that was near Geauga Lake or something like that back in the 60s, and there was a photo of my sister dancing with this fellow in full regalia, and apparently it was Russell Means. And then it's like I was old enough to remember Wounded Knee, and just like, and I've read and talked with folks over the years, and I've got friends that have either claimed Indian heritage and then have gotten genetic testing, like, lately in the last few years, and then they found out that they didn't have any Indian. And then other folks that have been completely surprised by finding that they've got, you know, genetically linked to tribes and have had, they've got that genetic match. So my question is, how has genetic testing changed how people are feeling and thinking about Indian heritage and history and inclusion in, like, greater society? And one quick question, since it was just brought up, you got your fellow there from NASA. There was a book that I've been trying. It was a fiction book, and it was about a mission to Mars, and one of the astronauts was Indian, and like American Indian, and made a big discovery. And I was just curious if he knew the title of that book, because I haven't found it, so I've been looking for it. I want to reread it. So, and thank you very much. Love the program.
Thanks, Scott. All right, so Aaron, any familiarity with what that book might be?
My first guess is maybe The Martian. I can't remember if one of the characters was Native or not, but that's my guess.
All right, and who can best answer if there's been any sort of kind of change in the perspective of people recognizing that they might have Native blood or not because of the genetic testing? Has that, you know, changed the game at all, do you think, Cynthia?
Has it changed the game? Not really. I think more people are finding out that they're not actually Native when they've been always told that they had a Cherokee great-grandmother princess in their family. There's some studies showing, I think, from Illuminative, which is a national Native nonprofit, showing that roughly a third of Americans firmly believe they have Indigenous blood, which statistically is really, if you think of the percentage of actual Natives, I mean, that it doesn't compute.
Right.
And anecdotally, that tracks. About one in three people like to tell me how Native they think they are every time they meet males. And honestly, it's a little exhausting having to constantly answer that question whenever you are introduced to somebody and they find out you're Native. But genetic testing is not actually accepted in zero of the federally recognized tribes as a thing for citizenship. So you can go ahead and try and send your DNA test to a tribe. They won't accept it. The way that tribes determine citizenship is through either kinship. They have a couple of other qualifications that make tribal citizenship happen, just as any other nation, U.S., Canada, Mexico, we all have our stipulations for citizenship. And I just want to point out that DNA testing is not one of those. And you can feel free to take it. But I think that Native identity is something very important. It's not just blood. It's not just DNA. It is absolutely kinship. And it means very deeply to a lot of Native people. And I think a lot of folks that are getting these DNA tests done, just they may not have a firm idea of what that identity means. Yeah. And so when you want to talk about being accepted into a community, it's a complicated topic and issue. We could have a whole session.
Yeah, I can tell. I can tell. And I guess your point, Cynthia, is it's not something to be just kind of frivolously taken lightly. And I'm not, I'm not alluding to people who think that they have Native blood to just that they're taking it lightly. But, an identity, a culture, a growing up with, a really being a part of the community.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's something that's different in your mind.
It is. And I think that's an important why we have shows like this PBS series, because
yeah.
it's really showing what our community is and what it is not. And most importantly, it's showing those kinship ties. It's showing the contributions in success, like Aaron Yazzie, he's over here putting things on Mars. And I really think it's important for people to view what Native people are, because there's, a very limited idea of who we are by the non-Native community and non-Native public. And this show in this series is flipping that script.
Okay, let's get back to Pam and Boots talking about the series specifically. The New Worlds episode I watched, and I thought it was really interesting in how you all kind of showed us different extremes, whether it was Aaron and NASA and the Mars rover, or it was Henry Red Cloud and his endeavor to increase housing by using that really bubbly concrete and trying to make homes for people on the reservation that could, survive that negative 25 degree day. Something as simple as providing sturdy housing for your people on your land, that seemed like interesting juxtaposition. So what was your approach, Boots, in kind of portraying all these different stories in this one episode?
Oh, sure. We'll get a little bit of feedback in my phone here. So, when we first started out, we kind of started out with topics, and we really wanted to show that cross section of Native America, people who were really trying to do good in their communities, or, in the work that they were trying to accomplish. And, these stories just kind of filter out to themselves. I worked with, I worked with Henry Red Cloud in the past before. Henry Red Cloud is a very, very cool traditional guy. And he's actually the Fort Laramie pipe carrier. He's the traditional chief of the Lakota, but what he does is on Pine Ridge, lightning strikes, burn down a lot of the forest and things in there. And when I first met Henry, he was planting trees, and he still does this every year. Him and several other gentlemen are responsible for planting over 1 million trees on the Pine Ridge and on the Rosebud reservations.
Wow.
So, when I kind of made contact with him, and he told me about this new idea about his new Foam Creek housing and how he's really trying to improve the community value, and he says pretty clearly in the documentary that, sometimes there's four families living in a 1970s trailer that could be up to 30 people.
Yeah,
I remember
that line and thinking, wow, 30 people in essentially a tin trailer that didn't seem to have much infrastructure or support when you're dealing with these really cold days in some parts of those states.
Right. And, and he also says that, he's just doing, if he was living 150 years ago, he'd be doing the same thing. He'd be trying to, look out for the welfare of his people, trying to improve their situation. So when we kind of really look at technology, I think we really picked Aaron Yazzie from the beginning as a story that we kind of wanted to wrap some of these other stories around. There's technology in the Diné or the Navajo Nation. With Tanabaw Natani, the traditional weaver, there's a lot of mathematics that goes into weaving. There's a lot of, you know, and it's inherent knowledge. So when people are going into STEM fields, for some reason, they don't think of pushing Native Americans into those type of fields.
Right. And I love that connection as well, Aaron. You go and kind of visit with this the weaving tradition and then somehow make a connection between that and then the work you're doing, you know, sending devices and whatnot, rovers into space.
Right. Yeah. I remember a lot of the conversation that we had when we were meeting up. It's just how weavers are almost like natural engineers, the way that they have to plan out a project like way advanced and ahead of time. They have to understand exactly, like visualize what the end product is going to be of their weaving. They have to, traditionally we used to dye the yarns that we would use with natural plants and around in the desert. And so they're likely natural botanists, knowing exactly where to find the plants, how to grow them, how to use them for making beautiful colors and then creating this pattern. They also had to plan out exactly the size that they wanted to make this rug and build this structure and then plan out the time to do it. So I was sort of showing like, oh, that's what I do with my job too. Like I have to plan out all that stuff. I have to be a good project task manager and visualize the end product.
I want to play a cut from the episode where Henry Red Cloud talks about the work that he's doing and why he thinks it's important for his people.
We're taking these steps. We're doing these things, taking the old way and recognizing that and merging it with the 21st century way and decolonizing ourselves in that process.
So, Pam, I thought that was so poignant, you know, taking the old way and incorporating that into the new and what you're doing in the everyday, and part of that an effort of decolonizing ourselves, that we're decolonizing ourselves. How much of that is in your frame of mind in approaching this series? And I think just generally the survival and the work of the Native American people in today's society.
Well, I don't think it's like a, you know, it's not something that we say, okay, I'm going to do this. It's just it's who we are. It's what we do.
Right.
You know, Native traditions are transforming, you know, life, you know, our lives, in our everyday lives all the time. I think what people really like about the series is that it demonstrates how we bring our values to our everyday lives, and they're so pleasantly surprised by it. You know, Indigenous people are communally based societies.
Right.
So, for example, there are groups that take into consideration 7 generations into the future as they make decisions. You know, for the community. For example, let's take, everybody knows about Indian gaming, and they know that there are some very wealthy tribes in the, you know, throughout the country. Well, it's not, you know, when they go into like a gaming facility that's owned by tribes, those funds that are brought in to the community from gaming, they don't go to one or two people or a small group of people. Those funds go to the community, and they go into projects that help the community. You know, it could be roads, schools, housing, those kinds of things. So it's a big difference in that worldview when you're thinking about your community and the community needs and what we'll need in the future versus let's enrich this small group of people who own, you know, this industry or, you know, or this company or whatever, you know, whatever it may be.
Right.
So I think that's what makes people, you know, why they feel so good after they watch the episode. It's because it's a different worldview, and it's a, you know, a pleasant one. It's not all about, you know, getting over on the next person.
Pam, we are
getting over on.
I apologize. I'm going to have to cut you off because we are running out of time. I just want to ask Cynthia really quickly. You have like 20 seconds. How do you think this series can resonate with Ohioans?
I think this resonates with Ohioans. This is a story that is often not heard and needs to be heard. As you know, in my work at City Club, we're often lifting up voices that aren't heard. So you can learn something. You can get the information you need to make better choices. So tons of businesses and organizations can really take a leaf out of the book of what's happening over here in this PBS series.
Cynthia Connolly, Director of Programming at the City Club of Cleveland. Aaron Yazzie, Mechanical Engineer at NASA. Charles Boots Kennedy, Producer at Providence Pictures. And Pam Belgard, Producer at Providence Pictures. I thank you all for joining me this morning. And we are out of time on The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for listening. We'll speak to you again tomorrow.
You're listening to WKSU, Kent, a public media service licensed to Kent State University and operated by IdeaStream Public Media. WKSU serves Northeast Ohio through HD and on WCPN Lorain Cleveland, WKRW Worcester, WKRJ New Philadelphia, WKSV Thompson, WNRK Norwalk, W239AZ Ashland, and W234CX Mansfield.